Bob Kerr, qui est professeure associée au département d'anglais de l'Université Concordia, où elle est co-organisatrice d'une équipe de recherche sur le féminisme et l'humour controversé au Center for Interdisciplinary Studies in Society and Culture. Elle termine présentement un manuscrit d'un livre soutenu par le FRQSC intitulé « Alone Together, the Intimate Closet in the 18th Century Social Imagination ». Elle travaille également sur un nouveau projet qui explore la variation d'émotions représentées et générées par la satire britannique au 18e siècle. Ses articles ont été publiés notamment dans Studies in 18th Century Culture, History of the Present, Afroban Online et plus récemment dans Los Angeles Review of Books. Aujourd'hui, elle présentera Ingeniously Tormenting, Jane Collier and the Satire of St. Petersburg.
Non, j'arrête. Hi, bonjour. J'aimerais dire premièrement merci beaucoup à Fanny et Marie pour l'invitation de participer à ce colloque. Et j'apprécie beaucoup l'opportunité de vous parler d'un livre qui continue de me fasciner et provoquer. Maintenant, je parle en anglais, mais je serai très heureuse de recevoir vos questions en français après. Et j'essaie de parler un peu plus lentement. Alors, j'ai changé le titre de ma présentation un tout petit peu. It's called Against Kittens, the Satire of Empathy, an Essay on the Art of Ingeniously Tormenting. The satiric premise of Jane Collier's Essay on the Art of Ingeniously Tormenting is that it will train readers to become experts in emotional abuse. When this mock conduct manual was first published in London in 1753, the effective dimensions of private life were increasingly valued. Domestic architecture was changing to accommodate more intimate interactions in the home. Marriages of alliance were giving way to marriages for love, arranged by the couple themselves. Or in any case, the novel was invented to insist that they should be. It was understood for the first time that children required not just discipline, but nurturing in order to thrive. And though servants were now contractual employees of their masters, rather than quasi-family members, their bonds, too, were less bound by duty and obligation than ever before. Philosophers like Adam Smith and David Hume began to theorize empathy, or sympathy, as it was then called, the capacity to feel what another person is feeling, as the foundation of morality. Narrated by an upbeat abuser with a passion to share her secrets, Jane Collier's Essay on the Art of Ingeniously Tormenting is, among other things, a proto-feminist inquiry into the dangerous flip side of all this apparently positive emotion concentrated in the home. My title refers to a line from Against Empathy, The Case for Rational Compassion by psychologist Paul Bloom, published last year. In the opening pages, Bloom writes that from friends and acquaintances' reactions to his topic, he has learned that being against empathy is like being against kittens, a view so outlandish that it can't be serious. But Bloom is seriously worried about the widespread, unquestioning investment in our feelings and in empathy in particular. He builds a logical case against it by citing recent studies that show how empathy privileges personal stories over systemic problems and how it reproduces unconscious biases against racialized and other marginalized people. While understanding someone else's feelings makes us feel good in both senses of that word, he finds that it is far less likely than cool statistical analysis to lead to actions that will actually make things better for society at large. Thus, Bloom argues we should consider empathy, despite what Hume and Smith argued, and however much the experience pleases us, as, at best, a morally neutral pattern of feeling. Though Jane Collier expressed her concerns far more obliquely and with dark humor, she was wary of empathy too, insofar as it is a basic ingredient in the kind of damaging relationships that are her main theme. To make sense of Collier's anxieties, we need to consider, first of all, the original distinction between exterior and interior power at the heart of her satire. In the essay, exterior power refers to legal and customary forms of dominance. It might remind us of the still very common emphasis in feminist discourse on the shadow cast by capitalist heteropatriarchy over interpersonal relationships and the presumption that in any relationship, the person on top is always the one belonging to the group or groups that have the greatest political, socioeconomic, or even physical influence in society. In part one of the essay, the tormentor persona advises readers how to make the most of this widely recognized form of power, wherever they have it. Masters and mistresses who wish to abuse their servants must continually lay traps for them. Patronesses seeking to amuse themselves at the expense of their living companions must carefully watch in what things their dependents are most diligent to please them, and be sure never to appear pleased with any such endeavors. Husbands should praise their wives for what they do not deserve, and overlook every good quality they are in reality possessed of. Parents looking to torture their children should let them entirely alone to their own wills, since that is the surest road to lead them to their own destruction. However, the longer part two of Collier's essay calls attention to a different source of power, whose force is determined not from outside, but from within domestic relationships, by the affection of the person with whom you are connected, that is, their feelings of attachment to you. Significantly, interior power is able to override the visible power structures of law and custom. The modifier interior suggests both interiority, the abstract state of inwardness where emotions are experienced, and the inside of a house, where in the 18th century there was more room for intimacy than ever before. Romantic love exemplifies the wild and arbitrary form of attachment in which cruelty and dysfunction can flourish. Romantic love, in other words, exemplifies the power that comes from interior power. Indeed, according to Collier's tormentor persona, interior power is so much more potent than its well-known counterpart that she advises the exchange of the former for the latter wherever possible. In the case of the husband, for instance, no one carried this sport of tormenting very far, but by dropping his marital authority and teasing his wife through her real love and regard for him. In fact, the stronger the victim's emotional attachment, the more effective the abuse. Thus, only a well-loved wife can create an impossible situation for her husband by being out of humor when he brings company home, being angry if he grows abroad without her, and troublesome if he takes her with him. An ordinary husband wouldn't even notice the difference. If you're going to tell another woman all sorts of spiteful stories that you have heard about her, and then later steal her boyfriend, the pain you cause will be that much more exquisite if she considers you her very best friend. Even well-meaning people can unwittingly become gifted tormentors by refusing genuine offers of help from friends. Paul Bloom jokingly compares the mass appeal of empathy to that of sweet, fluffy kitties. What kind of sociopath doesn't love both of them? In light of Bloom's comparison, there's a special irony in realizing that when cats turn up in Collier's book, as they often do, they point up the potential for harm within all emotional relationships and the perverse centrality of emotional intelligence in abuse. Implicitly, cats trace out the polarized positions that women in particular tend to occupy in the treacherous emotional terrain of the household. On the one hand, just as women are disadvantaged by the structural limitations to their exterior power, cats are always subject to the whims of their owners, on whom they are dependent, and to whom they feel attached. Thus, they can become pawns in their owners' abusive games. For instance, cats have a part to play in the torment of servants. The tormentor narrator notes that if the animals are properly encouraged and never tamed, they will be so liberal of their teeth and claws that thy servants will in general be bit and scratched all over. More importantly, servants' self-worth can be quickly eroded when masters and mistresses ignore them while showing the most extravagant fondness they possibly can for their pets. Parents are instructed to teach their children, under the name of fun, to torture cats and other small animals. Associating the suffering of littler things with their own pleasure and amusement guarantees, even more surely than physically abusing them would do, that children will become ambassadors of pain on their parents' behalf. On the other hand, Collier's cats also cue us to consider the ways that women, because of their necessarily limited exterior power, must take and give affection in order to ensure that they have interior power to draw on. Originating in the late 17th century, the idiomatic phrase, the game of cat and mouse, refers to an apparently endless chase. The phrase is derived from the hunting behavior of domestic cats. Biologists speculate that cats often appear to play with prey by releasing them after capture because they instinctively need to ensure that the prey is weak enough to be killed without endangering themselves. Collier's tormentor narrator invokes these feline instincts, both at the start and the end of her book. The tormentor narrator's final cat image is of the savage, tender dance that leads to the mouse's death. The cat not only sticks her claws into the mouse, making it feel the sharpness of her teeth without touching the vitals enough to render it insensible to her tricks, but she tosses it over her head in sport, seems in the highest joy imaginable, and is also, to all appearance at that very time, the sweetest, best-humored animal in the world. Yet should anything approach her that she fears will rob her of her plaything, she swears, she growls, and shows all the savage motions of her heart. As soon as her fears are over, she again resumes her sport. Readers should aspire to this level of precision and mastery in their abuse. However, the image, the frontispiece engraving at the start of the book puts the emphasis on the quiet moments that precede and repeatedly suspend the cat's sadistic play. A well-kept gated country house extends into the horizon on the right-hand side. Is it still the right-hand side? Yes, it is. On the right-hand side of the engraving, signaling the book's focus on everyday relationships. At first glance, the plump cat, reclining in the foreground, seems to mediate tranquilly between the household and the surrounding countryside, and to symbolize the harmony between humans and nature on the estate. The motto from Horace, arching above, celebrare domestica facta, celebrate domestic affairs, reinforces the modest dignity of the scene. It's only when we follow the cat's gaze and her soft paw left and down to the mouse she is touching, and then along the curve of his dark, skinny tail out of the picture frame to the English epigraph, that this scene of peace is unsettled. The cat doth play and after slay. The cat, of course, is both a lover and a fighter, a player and a slayer, but the picture suspends the drive toward slaughter in order to show us instead a relation of codependency in which the cat and mouse sit in communion with one another, an intimate, even empathetic couple. Though the intended meaning of Collier's satire, like, I would argue, all effective satires, is almost infinitely open to interpretation, it is this paradoxical dimension of emotional abuse represented here that I find most challenging and most prescient, perhaps especially in the context of our Me Too moment, when so many complicated, painful stories of harassment and exploitation are in circulation. In both parts of Collier's book, whether the tormentor narrator is addressing an abuser with exterior power or one with interior power, she continually reminds her imagined abusers in training of the necessity of understanding victims' motives and desires, and of reading their emotional turns, of knowing when to let them recover and when to renew the attack. Thus, the would-be tormentor of children is instructed to study the tempers of your sons and daughters, to see what they most delight in. And as you have an absolute restraining power, exercise it where it will be most strongly felt. Likewise, the would-be husband tormentor must carefully study her husband's temper and find out what he likes in order never to do any one thing that will please him. At the same time, the tormentor narrator continually asserts that there is no pleasure in tormenting unless the victims are fully emotionally present in the relationship. For instance, if ever you perceive that your companion has got above any concern about what you can say of her person, you must immediately change your method and begin to attack her in some other way. A servant should be dismissed if she is worked into a proper indifference about pleasing you, so that you should find that she minded very little what you said to her, only considering yours as a profitable place that she was resolved to bear all your tricks for the sake of your money. Where Paul Bloom focuses on the detrimental effects of empathy on broadly social situations, Jane Collier showed, more than 300 years earlier, that there are close interpersonal relationships as well in which empathy is best avoided.